case is taken under advisement. Move to the fourth case of the day, Quantum Management versus University of Chicago Hospital. Mr. Parker.
Good morning, Your Honor.
As indicated, I'm Dave Parker. I'm here on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Quantum in this contractual dispute. The issue here is whether Plaintiff Quantum Management is entitled to an additional payment under a contract between the University of Chicago Hospitals and Quantum, which called for them to establish the Family First program involving Medicaid patients to University of Chicago Hospitals. And the issue here, specifically, is whether defendant who had undertaken to keep monthly financial records and did so except for a six-month period when plaintiff can present some evidence but cannot present numerical evidence that the plans became profitable within the meaning of the contract, whether that is sufficient to A, create a question of fact such that summary disposition is the Michigan term, whether summary judgment is improper, and two, whether that's sufficient to call up the state doctrine under the law of Illinois called wrongful prevention, where if the acts of one party are that which are wrongful, which should have been done, and which prevent a plaintiff from prevailing in a claim, whether that can stand in the way of plaintiff prevailing in that claim. The facts which show that the plan was likely into the profitable territory are set out in our brief. They show, Plaintiff's Exhibit 13 shows that the plan was profitable for the months of May and June if one uses a 62% rather than an 83% factor in assessing the costs. Various statements made by Nicole Pavic and the other agents of the University of Chicago Hospitals indicating to my client, to the principal of my client, Mr. Fay, that the plan had become profitable at that point. And in exchange in Exhibit 9 showing that for this six-month period, the medical expenses could only be estimated. The raw material necessary to show whether or not my client could prevail and receive the additional payment under subsection 4.B, sub 2 of the contract was unavailable to him at that point. It could be created, perhaps, at great expense and time at my client's behalf. My client was not obligated to do so and, in fact, could not do so at that time. And based then upon an assumption that March was the month at which the break-even point occurred, and that the June enrollments were less than 120% greater than the month of March, the district court granted summary judgment in this case. Please excuse me as I trip out the Michigan terms and get into the federal terms.
It's all right, we'll figure it out. Go ahead.
Defendant alleges in its brief that the obligation of keeping records was plaintiff's and cites you to another contract provision, subsection 3, I believe. But that was the obligation of keeping the records of the ongoing plan. In other words, as long as plaintiff was administering the plan, he had to keep the records of who the patients were, what they did, what they owed, etc. The obligations of determining the applicability of the 4B2 payment was always undertaken by defendant and was always done by defendant. And indeed, when the profitable sale of this plan was eventually achieved by defendant, it did so using the types of numbers except for the six-month period that my plaintiff would have needed to prevail under his claim. This is it in a nutshell. If this court accepts this basic position, then the trial court exceeded its authority in granting summary judgment in this case. There are other arguments, but I will rest on my brief. If we don't prevail on this one, the case isn't worth the candle. So if there are any questions, I will take them. If not, I will sit and listen. All
right. Thank you, Mr. Parker.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Casey?
May it please the court. My name is Michael Casey, and I represent the defendant, Appley, the University of Chicago Hospitals. The magistrate properly entered summary judgment in this case in the hospital's favor because he found that the appellant could not show that he could prove several essential elements of its claim. In this case, the appellant has the burden to prove that it has a right under the contract to these additional fees, the monthly and annual fees that it seeks. However, under this contract, the appellant is not entitled to any of those fees unless it can first establish that certain explicit conditions of profitability in that contract have been met. The magistrate concluded that there was no such evidence presented by the appellant below in the record to establish that it ever met those two explicit conditions of profitability, and as a result, summary judgment was properly entered in my client's favor by the magistrate. Now, I would agree with counsel that his case lives or dies on this proposition about who was responsible for putting together these documents. And it is quite clear, in fact, from the contract itself, that it was the appellant who was required to put together the basic financial information about this plan. It was the appellant who was hired by the hospitals to run the plan. It was the appellant who had control over the numbers necessary to prove whether or not that plan was generating a profit or not. This whole notion of the wrongful prevention doctrine, that presumes that there was some wrongful act that in this case the hospitals committed. Well, the hospitals did not have the duty under the contract to prepare these reports. The hospitals did not prevent the appellant from achieving a profit out of this plan. It was in the hospital's benefit to get the profit out of this plan. And the hospitals did not prevent the plaintiff appellant in this case from proving its case. We explained to the appellant during the course of discovery what it was that it had to do to try to get the raw data, which is available, have an actuary review the raw data, and then break it down month by month, and by that way determine whether they could meet their burden of proof in the case. The fact of the matter is that the appellant, as I think counsel has admitted in his argument, did not take the time or spend the money to develop the proof that they needed to prove their case. And for that reason, the magistrate found that there was no evidence in this case to prove that these explicit conditions of profitability were met. And there were two such explicit conditions in this particular case that the contract explicitly provided, the first of which is this plan had to achieve an operating gain as computed on an accrual basis using generally accepted accounting principles. It's a very specific standard that they had to meet and prove before the magistrate. They also had to prove this other requirement. He had to prove both of the conditions. He had to prove that the level of enrollment in this managed health care plan exceeded 120% of the break-even level of enrollment. Counsel says that there's evidence below in some exhibit which shows that the plan achieved the level of profitability. I haven't seen it. The magistrate never saw it, because the magistrate specifically concluded that there was no evidence that the appellant ever showed to the magistrate to establish that those conditions of profitability had been satisfied. In fact, the magistrate found just the opposite, that the only financial information that was presented in this record below was the information that the hospitals were able to supply, which proved that there was no operating gain in any 1 month, be it March or May of 1998. And the appellant below, you would think that the very first step in trying to make these calculations under this contract is to first determine when the plan broke even. But the appellant has not even said with any degree of certainty when that was. They said in one answer to interrogatories, well, March 1998. And then in their fourth try to answer the same interrogatories, they said it was May of 1998. But in neither case was there any evidence to establish that either one of those months turned a profit for this particular plan. And in any event, even if they were able to establish that the plan met that first condition, there's not even a mention in their appellant's brief of the second, equally important condition, that they established that the level of enrollment in this plan in any one of those months exceeded 120% of the break-even level of enrollment, which is basically what the magistrate said too. The magistrate said, look, you can put all these numbers aside. Did you ever reach the 120% requirement? And the clear evidence was that they did not. The official data from the Illinois Department of Public Aid, which tracks all the enrollees in this particular plan, shows that whether you take their March break-even date or their May 1998 break-even date, under no circumstances could you then extrapolate a 120% enrollment satisfaction of this condition in this particular case. So the evidence below, as the magistrate found, was completely absent on these two issues. So not only have they not failed to prove the essential elements of the claim, but they have not cast any doubt on the only financial information below, which disproves this claim. Now, there are other reasons why the appellant is not entitled to the fees that it seeks in this particular case. Once the state contract terminated, they weren't entitled to fees under the language of the contract, and the appellant was required to first prove that it was terminated for cause, which we don't believe that he did below. But the very fact that this appellant has not come up with any solid evidence to prove that they ever broke even and that they ever met the 120% requirement is enough in and of itself to affirm the magistrate's order. Now, it's almost preposterous to think that the terms of this contract were to provide them with a benefit in the event the plan made a profit. And in this particular case, the appellant is trying to seek a share of a profit from a venture that lost money. It lost more than $10 million in less than 2 years. And so on this record, the jury could not return a verdict in favor of the appellant, and that's why the magistrate ruled as he did on the appellant's claim. But the magistrate also ruled in the favor of the hospital's counterclaim in this case, in large part because of the admissions that the appellant made as to the essential elements of each of the hospital's counterclaims. For example, it has admitted that it continued to charge and receive $26,000 a month for 5 months for the services of a chief executive officer who didn't even show up to work during that period of time.
Why was it paid?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why was that paid?
Well, it was paid probably through oversight more than anything else, because the way this worked is they constantly submitted monthly invoices to my client, and those monthly invoices were paid in terms of expenses, and they were paid $2.1 million on this project, and that, I think $130,000 was one, the $26,000 per month was one of the entries that they submitted. And so perhaps they should have caught it, but they didn't. It also has admitted that it failed to return a $2,026 security deposit, which they admit that wasn't theirs. They admit that they were responsible for selecting a management information system that was capable of complying with the state reporting requirements. They did not do that. Under the contract, they clearly were required to do that under Section 3E. And they've admitted that they agreed to split equally an increase in their consulting fee, and they admit that they never paid it back. Now, these admissions, we believe, are only highlighted by the cursory one-paragraph effort that they made in their appellant's brief to address the more than $447,000 in damages that the magistrate awarded to the hospitals on their counterclaim. Your Honors, unless you have any other questions, for these reasons and the reasons set forth by the magistrate in this memorandum of opinion and order, we ask that the magistrate's opinion be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Mr. Casey, Mr. Parker.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just 3 points. One, as I've indicated in my argument, if all we are ever going to be permitted to present is what was presented to the magistrate, then we can have no quarrel with the magistrate's finding. We believe that we were wrongfully prevented from discovering the month-by-month necessity of the defendant, the numbers of the defendants that would have shown that the plan became profitable in early 1998. And two, the amount of lost money over the term of the plan is irrelevant. The plan was expected to lose money early on. That's why the break-even point was the magic place in this contract, not a profitability point. It was expected to lose money for a large part of its operating time because this sort of project starts out in the red and gradually, if it's done well, works its way into the black, and it was just working its way into the black when the plug was pulled on it. And finally, he was hired by the hospitals to create a plan that would eventually generate a profit, but the hospital was actually undertaking the task of monthly calculation regarding the applicability of the 4B2 additional payment, and I've cited specific exhibits which show that they did so except in this crucial 6-month period during which I believe they were contemplating the sale and therefore did not want to know whether or not this had been triggered. The enrollment was increasing every month, and the exhibits show that as well. For these reasons, because we created questions of fact with these missing 6 months, and because the doctrine of wrongful prevention is implicated by the missing 6 months, we ask that this court reverse the decision of the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Parker.
Thank you,
Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. Court will proceed to the fifth case.